listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
For the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have film composer, theme park composer, and TV composer, Chris Thomas. Did I get all the composers out?
That's plenty. We'll work with that.
It's all good. I have to tell you, I read your bio, and I've done some of the Void 4D experiences that are now closed. Which ones did you compose music for?
Oh, it was in the early days. I'm trying to remember.
Was it Star Wars or was it?
It was just before Star Wars.
Ghostbusters?
It was right around that time. I didn't do the Ghostbusters one. There was like a Gothic Dragonland thing.
Okay.
Because I was doing stuff when they were in like all the beta and pre-beta, because I worked on the Evermore Adventure Park with Ken and
That's the people awesome. Who were
creating. So I kind of was like in the testing phase for those shows.
So
we
do you
did get some small ones? Yeah.
Do you get like? I mean, how do they send you the experience? Like, is it? They send you kind of like a rough idea of a video of it, or how does that work?
Yeah, well, there was like a lot of animation and like schematics. So, you know, we've come a long ways from like model building and just looking at schematics with like loose timing markers. So I could watch a lot of animated material before it was even like finished. So it was it was closer to scoring a film than it was doing like a theme park thing. It was a space in between the two.
That's awesome. Well, let's go way back. You grew up in Bend, Oregon. Did you grow up in Bend, Oregon, or was it another city?
I grew up 4 hours farther east out in the countryside in Pendleton, Oregon, which is famous for its roundup and its rodeo. And my dad was a rodeo director out there. And so
that's amazing.
Pretty far away from LA and film and theme parks. Yeah.
So let's ask you, how did you get into film music, or how did you get into making music? Was it a movie that did it? Was it a band or a symphony or a composer? What got you into music?
Yeah. It was a combination of things. They all sort of came together in gloriously catastrophic fashion. Music was the only thing I was good at. I realized I loved all the arts. I wanted to be an illustrator, but awesome. I wasn't quite as good as I was in music. And I wanted to do more like visual storytelling stuff, but I was still just better as a musician. I thought, oh, this is my strength. But my love, I was finding, was really film. And cinema was what really excited me. So like the films of Hitchcock, Jacques Demy, Akira Kurosawa, and Fellini and those old school guys really, really motivated me to stay in the arts. And one day I realized, oh, now wait a minute. All of these composers or all these filmmakers tend to work with the same composer over and over. You know, Toru Takemitsu with Kurosawa, yeah. Just like Steven Spielberg and John Williams.
Yep.
Then Alfred Hitchcock. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I realized, oh, wait, a composer can have this lifelong relationship with a filmmaker and still be working in service to film. And I thought, oh, I think that's what I'll do with my life. I will serve motion picture this way. And so that's what motivated me to practice and really learn.
So did you start with piano? Did you kind of vary different instruments? Did you kind of do a bunch of instruments? Did you learn orchestration? How did you kind of jump into all of it?
Yeah, I started on piano because we had one at home and it was the first thing right in front of me. And I was improvising and mostly listening to stuff in movies or on records, radio, and just trying to learn to play it at the piano. So I was ear training before I really knew that's what I was doing. And as I realized I was creating musical ideas, I fell in love with the cello. So the cello became my primary instrument. And that's what I studied through college and everything. But the piano is what I still sit at all day to do my work. And because of the cello, I was playing with symphony orchestras in the region since high school. And that was how I learned orchestration. It wasn't necessarily music school because if you spend enough time in symphony orchestras, what you find is, you know, in rehearsals, conductors will stop. They'll say, you know what? Everyone's just really slamming away here. So how about we have just first oboe, clarinet, two violas, double bass, just that group play. And then you hear this really important musical line and be like, that's what's important right here. Everyone else down. And I thought, oh, that combination of colors is what the composer wanted. And so then I began to log, oh, Brahms likes to do this with winds. Beethoven does that. Prokofiev does this. And these conductors were just teaching me orchestration for 20 years. And that's, I feel like, how I learned how to write for orchestra.
That's amazing. Do you find that your voice really comes out on piano more than cello? Or do you feel like because cello has been your driving voice for, you know, when you were in school, do you find that is your voice for when you want to write like a melody or come up with something?
Yeah, the cello, I feel like, makes the music real. Like my relationship to the piano is I have this idea I'm working out harmonic progressions and like voice leading my way through all the details. And it's a real instrument, but to me, it just feels like a problem solving space. It's like a calculator for musicians. And I can play pretty well, but it still feels more like a problem solving tool. But when I switch and I try a musical line on the cello, it becomes a real musical line. I feel it like through my whole body when I play. And it'll give me a whole different sense of the impact of a tune. And so I feel like the cello is how I test it for real.
So do you do like a lot of, like you'll write something on piano and then you'll double things on cello and kind of make like a mock orchestra, you know, like kind of like doubling lines or kind of getting some kind of a string arrangement that's rough? Or do you do it all with MIDI and you do it all on the keyboard?
Yeah, I do all the testing on a piano and I take very loose pencil paper sketches, just making sure the voice leading looks strong. And just work out some issues just very roughly on paper. Then I go, and then if I'm not sure about a piece of material, I'll try it on the cello. And if it doesn't sit right in my fingers, then I rethink the whole thing. But if it can pass the cello test, or I might pick up another instrument. I might get a violin or something else that's just not a keyboard.
Right.
And if I like the feel of it, then I go right to the full orchestra mock-up. And I have 450 instruments open at all times in Logic. And I just go right into every single part and just start orchestrating so that I can hear it all come back at me and see if I like the balance.
How do you feel about, like, I've done some orchestrations on Logic, and when it comes to the notation, it drives me crazy because it's, like, not intuitive with the keys. Or so it's like I found myself kind of looking at that going, oh, man, this is not right. This is right to the computer. This is like AI kind of logic, you know. But do you get a little frustrated with that kind of, you know, input from, you know, something that you're using as a sketch pad? Or are you able to just to kind of like go in there and make quick changes and you know exactly how it should be, like on Finale or something else?
Yeah, I mean, I've written, you know, 1,000 hours of fully orchestrated stuff at this point, having done it on so many films and TV shows and a concert orchestra. I've just spent so much of my life in the full orchestra and working with it that once it's sketched out on paper, I can project it right into full orchestra in Logic. That's and I know what it will do. And I don't correct notation in Logic. I finish it, make sure everything's playing back to me well. Then I export the MIDI into Finale. And then I can look at it like a score. And in Finale, you can really sort out your notation and orchestration.
Yeah, I feel like Finale is real work. Much better editing format. You know, I sang on one of Danny Elfman's first film scores.
Oh.
I don't know if you know the movie Nightbreed.
Oh, yeah.
And it was so cool because he was kind of an unknown composer at the time.
It's like 1990 or so.
Yeah, it was. I think it was 1988. I think.
That's right.
That's when we recorded, but the movie came out, I think, in 89. And it was so crazy because he was right next to me and he was like a mad scientist. And I remember him like running around. And he's like, hold on, I want to change something. And he went and did this rewrite and he photocopied it. And it was all like with pencil. And he just came back and gave us this like photocopied sheet music. And we were like, all right, new arrangement. And we just started doing these different parts. And, you know, after the session, I just left the, I left the music on the stand and walked out. But now I'm like, oh, my God, I wish I kept that because who
collectors.
No, yeah, it's a collector's item, you know. It's, like, so crazy. But, I mean, what I really found and respected is film composers or composers in general, they really have this masterful art of creation. I mean, it's, like, it's on a whole different level than songwriters or – you know, even screenwriters, whatever it is, because you are sculpting all the emotion and you're creating what's going to kind of be the rhythm section, the leading lines, the harmonies, and try to do it in a way where it's like not too much, where it's just enough and it's just right. I don't know if you saw the Hans Zimmer interview on 60 Minutes on Sunday.
I just sent a copy to myself to watch later, just
it's
today.
So good, and it's so cool because he talks about how he, you know, it took him years to get MIDI of instruments.
Yeah,
that was my that was the coolest thing, that he took years to get MIDI of people playing every string part, so that when he sits and his MIDI is just perfect, you know, it's like it's exactly what the way you want to hear it. So when you're writing stuff, like, do you start with a single line and you start building the theme, or do you kind of like start with building around it and then have a driving theme? Like, what's your process?
You know, I've never had a consistent one. Sometimes I hear these blinding bright chord progressions and I can hear this harmonic playing, and then I'm at the piano like searching and really trying to work my way to it. And then sometimes I hear a tune clear as day and it's just compelling to me. And then it's like, okay, harmonically, well, I have this melody, but how do I treat it here? Like, what harmony goes with this thing? And sometimes I just hear the full finished orchestration of stuff. Sometimes I just have to lock into some of the material and then I have to discover it. So it's like every other time I have the opposite breakthrough and the opposite problem. And some people always have the same process. They're like, oh, the melody first, or some, oh, I drift through these harmonic planes. And then a tune just easily, I'll easily find one for it later. For me, it's just one or the other. It's just back and forth. So I've never really had one consistent way of doing it.
That's awesome. And do you find that, like, sometimes a scene has, like, you know, because it has, like, okay, we need 4 minutes of music, that maybe you feel like once you compose something that the scene kind of almost can be a finite canvas? You know what I mean? Like, you, because you're limited. Yeah. Like, you have to create all this emotion in a quick amount of time and have it be through composed and arranged where it feels full. And then sometimes the scenes will leave things hanging and that's the end of the piece. Like, do you find that these movements are a little stifling, or does it feel like, I know exactly what this needs, I know exactly how to write for this emotional cue, and I'm in and I'm out, and I know exactly how to feel it out?
Yeah, with a scene, it's the easiest way for me because everything you need is right there. Right. For me, film has always been the most natural place. I find I struggle endlessly with concert music. It could take me a year and a half to write a small piece of music because I just don't have guidance. You have to just, you know, it's like you throw this bucket down a well. And sometimes, splash, I hit water immediately. I'm like, oh, wow, that was easy. There it is. Just reel this one up. Most of the time, I toss it down and just off into the darkness. And I'm thinking, oh, man, I don't know if there's anything there. Like, what have I done? Oh, no, I signed a contract.
Right.
And then eventually, a little splash. It's like, oh, I hit something. And I'll start reeling. But with film, it's like my first language. I get what the filmmaker's doing. I know where we are in the story. It's like, okay, we're in this act. We're at, you know, stage 6 or 11 or whatever in the hero's journey structure of the story. And I know what we're trying to accomplish. And then every different kind of scene has an editing style in it. And that editing style will have a certain rhythm in the cut that will tell you a lot about what the scene needs and when to lean in and just how to stay out of the way. And sometimes I'm just a little bit of activity in the background to coast by is all the scene needs. There's nothing profound. But then there's those moments where you need to go deep. It's a rich character moment. Nothing might be said, but you and the director have to figure out okay, it's all subtext. They're looking, they're thinking, they're all seeing the same thing, but we know they're thinking really conflicting stuff. And as a composer, they're like, this is what's going on. They think they're both thinking the same thing, but the audience has to know something the two of them don't. Now the power dynamic shifts in the movie. The audience knows everything. And the melody told them the truth. It's built into the story itself. And you're just there to get that information from the filmmaker and kind of narrate along a little bit. And so for me, a scene is much easier.
Do you ever feel like sometimes the creative vision of a director can be completely different than when the way you're sculpting a scene? Like you may have this fully composed section of strings and he's like, you know what? I don't want that. I just want a piccolo and a xylophone. You know what I mean? Like, how do you kind of cater without kind of like, and I find this too, with just like whenever I produce artists, it's like it's this careful, delicate balance of like not compromising the work so that it can still appease both parties. Like, how do you dance on that line?
Well, at the end of the day, the director wins. It doesn't matter. Right. That's what you do. We are lowly, humble servants of the pitcher. You know, that's what I always tell younger composers. Like, if you're looking to make a name for yourself or be a rock star, this is the wrong business. You humble yourself before the vision of the movie. You know, Danny and Hans, John Williams, they are rock stars because they so lifted the film in just the way it needed, no matter what they wanted to do with it. But they found a way to do it in an original voice that no matter what the direction was, they will still do everything in their power to lift the movie first. And when you make great movies, your reputation rises with it. So they had the right idea. It wasn't to say, well, what do I want to accomplish with this score? It's like, no. What can you say that's special for you, but through the needs of the movie first? And so ultimately that's what it comes down to. I'll fight for some things. I've definitely had conflicts where I to this day, there's a few things I still think the filmmaker didn't quite grasp where they were in the movie, you know, and what that scene needed. They were into a certain moment or a dynamic between characters, but missed the really big journey the character was on and what that transition was for them in the bigger plot. And I've fought over that before, but at the end of the day, they're like, I'm the director. I need this. Let's move on. And it's like, okay, I'll give you just what you need.
You're like, damn it.
Yeah.
You're like, composer zero, director one.
It's usually composer zero, director many.
That's funny. So let me ask you about this transition when you were leaving Oregon to go to USC's film school, super renowned program. We both went to SC. I was class of 2001. And what class were you? Were you the same year? Were you the year 2 years? I think you were younger than me, right?
I did grad school at USC, and I graduated in 2007.
Okay. Yeah, I knew you were a couple years behind me.
Yeah.
So tell me what that experience was like, leaving Oregon, like all of your comforts, to go into LA, into the thick of the circus of the movie industry, and also just the competition, because you know there's so many people trying to vie for positions. So tell me what that experience was like.
Oh, I loved it. I like difficult things. I like scary situations, challenges, things that terrify me. And this one was just a great adventure. And I knew no matter what happened, things would be okay in life. You know, my parents always reminded me, they're like, you know, you can go do stuff. And the one thing in life is that you'll regret not trying something and going for it. You can just wreck yourself in your 20s and 30s, and you can still just reestablish a great new life later on. They're like, you just can't lose. Like, just don't be afraid to go do something. Crash and burn if you have to, but you could just start again. They're like, don't like be dying one day and think, oh, I should have done a whole lot of things, but I just didn't. And why? You will always regret not trying something because you were afraid. And I always went into things with this attitude of like, wow, I might just ruin my credit. I could lose a house. I could, you know, do all kinds of things to really set me back, but they're just setbacks. But I can't not go try these adventurous things. And I always knew I could just come back to Oregon and give up someday and just live an awesome life doing something here. And And so, because right now I'm at my Oregon studio, and so these days I actually get to live here part time and still do what I do, because the world's changed in such a way. I was doing this years before the pandemic, but now no one asks me why I divide my time here. They're like,
oh, don't worry about it. They're like, yeah, normal. I did the same thing with my songwriting team. I started the songwriting team 4 years before the pandemic hit, and it was like normal for us. We were just still working the same way remotely, yeah, and kind of like doing it like that. So I love that. Did you get an opportunity to kind of pair up with directors at USC? Like, did they make that kind of opportunity happen, or was it, yes, you had to seek a lot of that out? Tell me what that was like for you.
Oh yeah. I got some internships on a handful of TV shows because I was a student at USC, and you know, you're just right across the yard from the film school. And so most of what we were doing was they always told us, don't hang out here in the music department. Like, all of you film dudes, get over across the yard and just, whenever you're not in class, hang out in the film school. Like, that's your future. And so that's what I did. I just hung out with filmmakers, and every term I would score like 5 or 6 short films at the end of the semester. And then even some years after SC, I was already working on some features, but I knew they were important to stay close to. So for 3 or 4 more years after I was out of school, I was still doing like 6 little short films for undergrads and graduate cinema students every term. And so I just kept doing those for years and years. And I probably did something like 30, 32 shorts at SC. Yeah. And then, because, you know, they had a contractor who would get like players from the symphony to come to the Williams stage, or that one under what's now the old cinema building.
Right.
That smaller room. And I would just say, hey, I need 23 string players. And they'd be like, great, they'll be there. And for just no charge, like $20 sometimes. I would just get per player, we would get an hour, maybe 2 hours, depending on the size of the film. And we would just have to whip that score into shape fast within an hour. So these were like 5 to 7 minute films. But 1 hour to figure out how to make the entire thing work in one shot was a great challenge. And after doing that 30 plus times, I learned a thing, and working in TV, you know, I learned a thing or two about how to make things work very quickly. And so I think being forged in that fire of intensity, rather than starting in features, we get like 2 or 3 months to do a score. Right. It was like, okay, I have like 3 days. I have to write 26 minutes of music and record. Damn. And after that, nothing's scary.
Right. So. Well, let's play something. What do you want to play us first?
Oh, what were some of the things I sent? Well, let's do something with film. How about Moose? That was a movie I did, an animation that had Kathy Bates and Samuel L. Jackson. And I just liked that score. It was a really fun experience.
Awesome. Here's Chris Thomas with Moose. That was awesome. That was super awesome. It's like Swampy meets like Triumphant Hollywood kind of parade over there, you know? Tell me about the scene and then kind of what inspired the direction.
Well, the director inspired it. That was right after the final scene in the movie. And they're kind of walking off into the sunset. But instead of them just walking away, you just kind of do a track shot along with these animated characters as they kind of wander off into this new day. And the credits are rolling. You're kind of passing all these creatures and stuff through the end credits. And it was a story about, you know, like revenge and guns and various topics like that. But something about after we recorded Samuel Jackson's narrations, and like the kind of vibe he brought to it, the director was like, you know, there's a few sounds I want to try out. And I started leaning into, because he was asking more about like my early years playing, you know, growing up out in the country, playing more gospel music and like fiddle and stuff. And he was like, can you put those together and come up with something and integrate it into the orchestral score that's also going to play through the film here and there. And then, you know, I got that tone going that I thought, you know, I think we need a singer for this. And we auditioned some, you know, like classically trained singers, and it was just so controlled and precise. And
that's secret sauce.
Yeah, and so I started putting feelers out, and then someone was like, you know, I met this vocal contractor who was like, I don't have someone I could recommend right away, but there's a handful of churches up and down Crenshaw Boulevard. Just start walking in and start asking around. And this one choir director was like, hey, you should meet my friend Desmond. They're like, if you need a session guy who can sight read, he's not your guy, but man, there's something in his voice. And so I met up with Desmond and he was like, yeah, I can come by and give it a try. So we got a studio in Eagle Rock and he comes in and he couldn't read the sheet music. So we would just, I'd play a line at the piano. We'd rehearse it with a mock-up and I'd play a little more. He was just memorizing it. And then he'd be like, I'm ready for some takes. And then I would just get out of the way and I was like, you know what? Just own it. Like you've got the notes, but do what you would do with them. Like take it for yourself. Don't let me, you know, tell you what to do at this point. I was like, those are just the starting pitches. And then he just owned the music. And
that's awesome.
And so that's how that sound originated.
But that's a testament to your character and your sense of letting the music shine through over the ego of the notes. Yeah. I mean, that is a huge like sense of delegation. And I have to tell you, like, there are a lot of people that wouldn't have done that. And I love that you did that, because I always, you know, like I love bringing in great musicians,
yeah,
and great singers. And I'm like, throw it down. Let's throw it down and make something awesome. And the more you get out of the way and you just let them be who they are, you end up with magic. That's like those are my favorite sessions. You know?
That's it. Yeah. Don't put a ceiling on someone's talent if it's sky high. Don't push them into the box. And like I gave them just a starting palette, right? And it's like recording jazz. If you try to notate your way through it all, it'll sound just comically stupid. And right. So you really have to just like, here's the chart, but like you're the experts here. Find the music in it, and they will. And that's the best. You're absolutely right. That is the best stuff. Yeah.
So let me ask you, do you kind of lean towards directions, like as far as genre? Do you have like, is it like, you talked about jazz, this kind of was like a very swampy kind of bluesy, progression. Like, do you gravitate towards soul music, jazz, classical, the composers, film music? Because there's so many different ways you can approach things. Like, how do you know what is the right approach?
Wow. I don't know that I really have a favorite. Like, my answer should be film music, but not really. I just like the terrain of possibilities out there. There's something beautiful everywhere. Like, some of my favorite music in the world is probably just some of the least popular. There's parts of, my favorite music has to be Balinese gamelan music.
Whoa.
To me, that's the most transcendently beautiful thing I've ever heard. And I played in Balinese orchestras for years, and it's a huge part of my writing. And there's a few regions in India that write for like Dilruba. Yeah, it's like Bansuri and Dilruba. And there's some of the most expressive instruments and music I've ever encounter. And there's a harmonic and melodic language that's not quite like ours, but there's just this flavor and a personality that's electric to me. And I could say, oh, classical or gospel, or, and those are important to me. You know, gospel and classical are how I was trained, right? But really, it's stuff like that. It's like Balinese gamelan set my imagination free.
That's amazing. I love that you said that. You're a worldly cat just by saying something like that, because what I find too is like when I watch a film, some of my favorite scores are when you hear Western instruments and you hear like an Eastern instrument being the melody and notes that are like not on the scale. And it's like, it just makes you feel emotion on a different level. So it's, how do you kind of find those moments where you can feel emotion in notes that aren't on the scale with using instruments like, you know, a lot of Eastern instruments, you know?
I never have to think about it. Like, it's just so beautiful to my ear. I'm not like, oh, I wonder if the director will like this. I just feel the spark of, oh, that's the sound. That's the language for this. And when you feel like, I remember at USC, Quincy Jones came and did a talk once, and I was still on this fence about like, oh, should I get a little smarter with my writing? Should I try to show a little more what I can do? Maybe that'll establish me as a cooler composer. But then I was like, wow, whenever I do that, no one ever likes the stuff I write. And it's like, it's always forced on its way out. And then when I just let this thing run wild, I feel, you know, that like spark of, wow, what was that? And you don't know why it's going to work, but you know it will. And I was trying to navigate those two things. And Quincy was at the campus visiting once. And he said this one thing that changed everything for me. He was like, you know, you could try to be the smartest, you could try to be this, but he's like, the only thing that carries you forward in your career is if it truly comes from the heart, it will go to the heart. And he was like, that's your metric. And I thought, oh my God, that made perfect sense. And it just lifted the pressure. And I thought, I'm not searching for any material at this point on, I'm searching for that spark. And if I feel it and believe it, and I mean, like you believe it here first, it will translate. You won't have to explain yourself. So that's why I just never think about that. I put the line in, and often they're like, wow, what is that? And why do I love it? You know, there's often not a fight. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's, there's so many composers that can be heady, you know, like they're thinking about notes and orchestrations and harmonizations and things like that. And that never moves me. It's like my favorite composers were Brahms, Mozart, Bach, like Chopin, and those guys, they felt things. Yeah, right here, exactly. Let's play something else. What do you want to play us next?
Since we're kind of on the orchestral thing, let's go to 13 Coins. That's from a movie called Haymaker I did. It had a theatrical release a few years ago. It's a film that also features my martial art of choice, Muay Thai. And I got the job because I not only used to fight Muay Thai a lot, but I'm also a string player. They wanted a string player to write like beautiful solo lines. And they wanted that to be the sound. Yeah. They were like, oh, we think you should do this film. So I guess we could try that one.
And what was the name of it one more time? 16 Coins?
The track is 13 Coins, but the movie's called Haymaker.
Okay, here's 13 Coins with Chris Thomas. Thank you. Beautiful, man. That was beautiful. I love the dissonance. You have some dissonance like way in the back, and then it resolves. I mean, oh, man. And I love that you use choral parts to kind of create some of the background and kind of substance to give it a little
bit.
I mean, it's awesome. That's all the stuff that we did. I remember, I even remember the music I sang for Danny Elfman's score, but I also did some other, I did a lot of horror movies, which is odd for having choral music in it, but.
Not really, though. There's a lot of good vocals in those.
Yeah, it's interesting how I love when composers still do that. Like, you hear it a lot in like the Harry Potter soundtrack. Right. And it's sometimes it's rare, like you don't always see that voice being, you know, maybe because it's always been done up until this time. But I love when composers still use that as a thing. How do you know when it's enough? You know, like where is that point where you're like, it's finished, it doesn't need anything else, or vice versa? Like, how do you feel when you know it's not finished?
Oh, well, all right, I'll start with the second point. When it's not finished, I just know it somewhere deep down. I don't know how or why. Something's just not there. But then I just won't go to bed until I know I've started to crack the code. There's no time. And so it's like sometimes I need to step away and just find a way to get out of my head for a minute and say, okay, like, let's look at this in a whole new way. And I start throwing very contradictory ideas at a problem to see if that distraction or looking at the music in a new way or thinking about taking it in a completely new direction makes me want to preserve it, or if it feels liberating to say, no, you're just not on the right path. Try again. And often I know after a bit, oh, I need to start it over. Or it's like, oh, maybe this is a way. Sometimes I just have to play around. I know I'm close, but I'm like, okay, what is it? What is it? Which layer? And then I'll find it eventually.
Do you ever find this? Like I do this, like my band doesn't even know that I do this, but like I'll make demos and I find myself like working in the middle of the night a lot of times.
Yeah.
And I have to get to a point when I'm listening where it's almost like a meditation to listen, and I'm in this, like, and it's really like it is nirvana for me. And it's in that moment where I kind of am like completely letting go, and I hear when the music's right, or I hear when it's completely wrong, like something needs to be there that isn't. And I find myself almost like sleepily coming up with parts or ideas, and then I have to just like, all right, I've done my work for right now, I'll listen to it with fresh ears. Do you find like working in the middle of the night, like you have these moments where it's like working through a meditation? Do you ever have that kind of, you know, late burning the midnight oil moments? I'm sure you do.
Well, I find the later the day goes, the clearer things get. At the start, I just don't function well first thing in the day. And I just don't hear anything. I need input and time to look at stuff, play around, reflect on it. And then it just keeps improving. And there's a point where I know, oh, I'm on to it. I need to take off with it now. And sometimes I always find my magic zone is from 7 to 2 a.m.
Wow.
And I'm trying to shift my days.
No, I mean, that's your thing. You know what I mean? Make it that's your thing. You know, I get it. Yeah. Now you've had some of your pieces, you know, played at the Hollywood Bowl by the LA Philharmonic. Tell me what that experience was like, because, you know, it's one thing when you make a demo or when you're kind of getting an orchestration, you hear it with MIDI instrumentation. Yeah. How do you feel when you see it done, and maybe a conductor interprets it in a different way than you would have written, you know, the way you wrote it? But tell me what that feeling and experience is like to hear it back to you by a famous Philharmonic, you know, in a place like Hollywood Bowl.
Well, it's like any really good orchestra in a really great venue, you know, because I've been to, like, I've done shows at like Sydney Opera House or Carnegie Hall, or every time I do something at like Sagerstrom Hall, it's really exciting because I love that room. And like the Pacific Symphony, you know, plays there. And it's a little otherworldly. I never believe it in the moment. It's a little bit like a dream. And I sometimes I wish I was like present in the moment, you know, but
what do you mean by that? That's
I disembody a little bit. I'm like, it's happening right now. Like, oh my God, I wish I could just chill and be like, let it wash over me. But I kind of fly out and I'm like, oh my God, this is it. That's my stuff. And it's like, you look around these venues and it's like, you know, like at Carnegie Hall, it's like, wow, you know, Tchaikovsky wrote the piece that like inaugurated this room. And if you walk down the little side corridors, there's like handwritten sketches with like, you know, from like Beethoven or John Adams or Steve Reich, Rachmaninoff premiered music at Carnegie Hall. And of course, like, and it's the same like when I first recorded at Capitol Records. I mean, it's technically a room for hire and there's just a studio. But when you're walking in to go do your thing, the first time I went in there, I got a little shaky walking past, you know, Sinatra, Judy Garland, all the pictures on the wall. And I was like, oh, this is the pantheon of the gods. And what am I doing? And because like when I, like sometimes I walk in and I'm there to hear a rehearsal or a run through. And often it's not like they're like, oh, composer, enlighten us. They're like, all right, let's just hit the main spots that we're struggling with. You have so little time to act. You never really hear it through in a rehearsal. Right. You only hear it when they go on, which is how the professional world is. And it kind of, I always feel like it puts me in my place a little bit. I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm not John Adams. I'm not Arvo Pärt. I was like, I get it. They could probably get more rehearsal time than I will. But all the same, that's your music in that space, you know, with those players. And you're kind of in these like locations where so much magic has happened. And then he's like, you just left a little bit of a trace behind. And I was like, wow, you know, I echoed in this arena. I echoed in Carnegie Hall. I echoed in the Opera House. And it's just like, wow, it's a treat just to know.
Yeah, I mean, it's an experience because like, you know, for me, whenever I write a song and play it, I'm experiencing the song. And for me, first time I had ever experienced it back was when I wrote a tune for Ziggy Marley and I watched him play it in front of like 10,000 people. And I was like, this is cool to hear something back. Like it was like I was an audience member too. Yeah. And you must have that experience so often, but it never gets old. Still, you're hearing it at the best that you could possibly ever get. And it's coming back to you and you're like, you get to swim in it. You know, it's like, it's an amazing experience.
It's never not trippy and dreamy. And I walk out of those places like, did that just happen?
Time is an illusion at those moments, right?
Yeah, it's really weird. And the thing is, I really disembody and it's almost like I'm not really present. And I wish I could just be there and like, oh yeah, this is great. Just let it hit me. But I'm so aware of what it means. It's like, wow, this is like something few people ever get to do. And it's like, I feel the luckiest I could ever be in those moments. You know, when you're at a recording session, whipping an orchestra through, it's like, it's really the same thing. You're lucky to be doing stuff like that in your life, but it's just so much pressure and you're just running them against the clock.
Right.
And you have to get done. And the union guy's like, you know, I'm cutting the take mid song if I have to at the end of this last hour. None of it sinks in. And then you kind of leave, you're getting into the mix and you're like, whoa, like I just did this thing. It's on the track. But it's the concerts that you can't do anything. You're stuck in a seat and you just have to absorb it. And I just kind of float away and I'm not exactly like in the moment, but I'm just very aware of what it is.
Well, that's the moment of like, you become present in those moments. You don't realize it when you know what I mean? Do you find that when you compose something, you record it, like when is the producer hat? When you have like the mixing engineer producer hat, like how do you find that perfect balance? Something I always wrestle with on every record. Like some things happen, you know what I mean? It just comes out a certain way. It's like you're getting it. You know, I have a phrase, you just need to get it to 98%. There's 100 ways to get it to 98%. Just get it to 98% and you're there, you know? How do you find to, like, you know, navigate through that balance when you're mixing or being a producer?
It's kind of like that story with Desmond. I've had to learn, I'm the happiest when I learn to let go of certain things. Because, so Adam Schmidt is my mixer. And whenever I turn the music over to Adam after sessions, I have this idea and he'll follow the way I mock it up and kind of produce it. Cause I give him a really good sense of where I'm trying to go, But sometimes he'll hear something in the balance where he's like, wow, these two things here should really be out there and they need to punch through a lot harder, because he can hear the balance in this way that I really can't. And he knows so much more about what's going on in the recording than I do. And at that point, what's on the track is what's on the track. And he'll be like, okay, here's what I got. And he's like, it might be a little different than you first expected. We can just dig back into this. But he was like, I think this is the right balance. Hit play. And sometimes it's such a shock. It takes me a minute. And he'll be like, I'll give you a minute. And he has to let me, it just detonates in my brain. Okay. Do I like it anymore? I used to panic and I would go back and forth and I would make his life terrible anymore. I'm like,
that's a good mix. Phobolitis, right?
Yeah. And it took a lot of years to learn to say, okay, it's never going to be what I thought it was. Even the recordings aren't exactly what I thought they were going to be, you know? And it's like, is the mix good? Do I like it? Does it represent what I want? Even more importantly, does it represent what the production needs? What the director approved? Is it all there? And sometimes it's like, great mix. But here's the thing. I went through a lot of back and forth with the director about what we're going to hear through from there to there to there. We need to reprioritize. And he'd be like, he always gets it. He's like, yeah, that's the most important thing. Right. Let's go do that now. We start pushing and pulling things. And, but really I learned the more I let him do his thing, he brings a whole new personality. Right. And it's like, I bring my full force as a composer, but when I let the engineer really bring the best of what they can do, then it takes another step up I didn't know was even there. And I do side-by-side mixes. Like when I go try it, when I think it should be a certain way, that I play what Adam did. And 100% of the time, every time, like over 10 years of working together, everyone I ever do the side-by-side, they only ever go with his.
Wow.
And 100%. I've never done a side-by-side where anyone ever favored my composer mix.
Damn it.
And that says everything you need to know, right? Right. He hears something I don't. And I've learned to say, well,
it's nice that you have somebody that can kind of like cater to making something more realized. You know what I mean? That you may not see. Like I always find, like, I've worked with so many amazing mixing engineers, and there's like this fine balance of like, if they have a new plugin, they want to throw a new plugin on something.
Yeah. He does that too.
Oh, no, don't do that. Don't do that. No, that's too much. And you have to kind of like reel them in a little bit, but then there's fine balance of like, when you both come to that place, it's really kind of a magical way to work with somebody when you really find that thing. So I always look forward to it, but it's always like, it's always a push and pull and a tug of war on something.
That's true. That's true. Even with us, sometimes it's like, okay, you're coming in really hot. I'm looking for a delicate score here. Like you've got this delicate recording balance, but it's so full and wide. And I can hear like 10 Manly compressors, like slam in different ranges, the highs and lows, you know? And I'm like, wow, it's intimate, but it's so hot. And it's like, can we set it back? Just let it make people turn up the dial a bit. It's like, I know that's not
you and I are like this, man. We see music in the same way. Yes, I struggle with that all the time. It's like, everybody loves compression and everybody loves tuning too. And I'm like, hey, you know, instruments are not intonated perfectly. It doesn't need to be like that. It can sound, there's like this small, I think it's like 3 cents, you know, where it's like, oh, that's okay. It doesn't need to be off. And most people don't always hear that. I'm sure you do. I know you do. Because it's just like, it is one of those things that when you're around orchestras or you're around choruses, you can hear that. And other people may not hear that. They only hear the imperfection and how it needs to be perfect. You know what I mean?
But over time, I've realized what I like the best and what most people seem to respond to at the end of it when the mix is done are the less than perfect takes on certain things. There's this human ness to it. There's an almost like an intimacy and closeness when you hear the person behind the vocal line or the cello part or the whatever. And over the years, like I'll like lay down a cello part or do whatever at my studio. And when I'm recording bits and pieces, I'm doing it because I captured the excitement of the moment I discovered something. And then I go to replace it later or bring in other people. We track it out and everyone's like, this is a really perfect take with this new bunch, but something's missing. And there's this initial power you can capture sometimes up front. And it's like, wow, my recording isn't particularly great, but whoa, the music is spot on. And like, I got something in the moment, and it's like, let's not replace that one. Let's keep that demo and we're going to mix it in. And then I need to replace certain things that I couldn't do properly. It's like, okay, we'll keep that. But then it's always the one people respond to is the one with the little bits of imperfection.
Yeah, it's because it's human. It's human. Yeah. Let's play something else. What do you want to play us next?
What else was there? Oh, let's go another way. Let's go into – so I didn't pick something from like a theme park, but this one's from a haunt attraction, because before I did bigger theme park scores, I started by doing like all the L.A. area, you know, haunted attraction scores, like Knott's Berry Farm, Hayride. And so it's like, oh, let's do some – metal clown horror.
Oh, I like this. All right. So what is this called?
I think it's not released yet, actually. So this is kind of a preview. I think the final name is going to be Bloody Barnaby's Big Top Circus.
Okay, we're going to call it Big Top. Here's Big Top with Chris Thomas. I saw Danny Elfman at Coachella last April.
Oh, yeah.
His band sounded like that. I was so surprised. I was not expecting this. And it's just so cool because it's got so much color and vibe, experimentation. It's got sounds. It's got character. It haunts you a little bit. You know, it's just it really cool. How did you kind of come up? What was that process like for you?
Well, you know, it's like just hearing that, it's just, you know, sometimes you look back at things you recorded and it's like, oh man, if people knew like all the weirdness that it took to get that, right. And all the people making noises and I mean, It's like, I'm just like, every time I hear those haunt ones, it's like, I mean, it's like some people, they go through an attraction and they're scared because it does its job in the moment. But I'm just hearing the weeks of all of us in the studio yelling and jumping around microphones and just breaking down laughing. Like, is this really going to be scary? Cause this is just so stupid, you know? But I'm like, no, just wait, we'll put it together. And
definitely is scary. That's for sure.
But just like film, it's like, okay, what's the scene? What are we doing? Like, what's the vibe? And then with the haunts, like, yeah, we have this thing coming later, and then it's going to be this like circusy thing. We got this ringmaster and fire and pyrotechnics, and we're thinking like, I don't know, like our evil circus master, but then it's like kind of metal and it's just something jagged, and
it really had a lot of Danny Elfman isms in there for sure.
Oh, I picked up a lot from Danny over the years. I mean, we all do, because like if you're going to do that combination of things, it's like you turn to the master.
Yeah,
and the harmonic language is very Elfman too.
But it's cool. You know? It's also unique and original because of the instrumentation. It's got like this edge. It's like Danny Elfman with an edge. It's got a cool thing. I love it.
I was also like a huge Nino Rota and Bernard Herrmann fan, so I feel like I get a lot from like Nino Rota, especially for this kind, like the kind of musical language. But I just put guitars on it and just a lot of slap bass myself.
So awesome. Well, that's what gives it the I'm being chased or something's going on, you know.
Yeah.
Chris, where can people find you if they want you to compose for something, or they can listen to your music? Where can people find you online?
Yeah, christhomasmusic.com. You can hear music, you can get in touch with me and my team. You can start just about anywhere. I've got all kinds of stuff up there. I've got a top secret page hidden with lots of bizarre content.
That's cool. I didn't see that. Let me go back and see that.
I've got a TED Talk up there. I've got all kinds of wackiness for your enjoyment. So, yeah, if anyone wants to visit, come say hello.
Well, Chris, you've been a wonderful guest. Thank you so much for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. We're going to have to collaborate on something. Maybe it'll be some weird haunted something or other because, man, that's my world. I like that stuff. But anyways, thank you so much for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. On behalf of Chris, myself, and Sam, we'll see you guys next week. Take care of yourselves. Happy New Year. And we'll see you guys next week. Peace and love.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Korula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.